Last month, WAMC presented an evening of conversation centered on the state of journalism, democracy, and upholding our First Amendment rights at Gallery 40 in Poughkeepsie, New York. The panel featured WAMC CEO and President Sarah Gilbert for a discussion with leaders in regional journalism that I moderated. Guests included David Krasnow, Executive Director of the New Yorker Radio Hour, Emily Sacker, founder of the Daily Catch, and Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. We're pleased to present a lengthy excerpt from that conversation this morning.
It is. It's amazing to be in Poughkeepsie. It is amazing to be with all of you. It's amazing to be in this gallery space. I have been lucky enough to spend a lot of time in this area. I've been doing a lot of events over at the Bardavon and other places in town. We have so much fun doing this, being out on the road and meeting all of you, talking about important things, talking about the media, talking about the importance of community, and to have all of you here tonight just shows that, and it's just beautiful to have you here. It's beautiful to all be together, and we have a great group. I think what I would like to do is have everybody introduce themselves, tell them the title of what they do. Go ahead, Casey Seiler.
I'm Casey Seiler. I'm the editor of the Times Union. I've been at the Times Union for about 25 years now. I arrived as the entertainment editor. I became the State House Bureau Chief, which is a very weird change of job, in 2008. I did that for about 10 years, came back to the newsroom, became the editor literally 3 weeks before COVID struck. So it's been a lot of fun. For the last 4.5 years, I'm proud to say that we've had a great Hudson Valley Bureau that has been doing fantastic investigative work, fantastic lifestyle work. But this is the first time that I have ventured down into the Hudson Valley to represent the Times Union. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Emily Sacker. I'm the founder and the editor of a small, hyper-local newspaper in the Hudson Valley that covers the towns of Rhinebeck and Red Hook, and as of 10 p.m. last night, Clinton. So we're growing.
What happened to 10 p.m.
Yeah, how did that happen? Did you win a card game or something? What happened?
We got a little funding.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Often what happens.
All right.
I started my career after college as a journalist. I worked at Newsday and then New York Newsday, some of you may remember back in the days of tabloid, quality tabloid journalism. And then I left the newspaper industry entirely, became an art historian, had another career really, and came up to the Hudson Valley in 2016, could not believe there was no local newspaper in our town and decided to start one. We had 83 readers. In our first, those were my friends. I don't even have 83 friends, but I pretended I did. And we're up to now about 17,000 readers.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. And I'm old, very old.
Clinton's going to double
my
that.
My grandmother project.
I'm David Krasnow. I'm the executive producer of the New Yorker Radio Hour. It's a program that's distributed on public radio stations around the country. Produced in partnership between WNYC and the New Yorker Magazine. We launched 10 years ago, 10 years and 3 weeks. We just passed our decade anniversary. I'm a 20-year veteran of WNYC before working with the New Yorker. I was the producer and then the editor of the late lamented program Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. I found my way into radio from a background as a print writer and editor, attempting to be a music critic and kind of hustling around for all manner of freelance work in print before getting to radio.
Sarah Gilbert.
So hello, everybody. My name's Sarah Gilbert. I am now the CEO and president of WAMC, as you can tell from the silly accent. I don't come from round these parts. I grew up in the north of England in a county called Northumberland, which is mainly known for being excruciatingly cold. It has castles and Roman walls and all that kind of stuff. I went to London as a late teenager, managed to talk my way somehow or other into the BBC, stayed to work on the international desk for more than a decade, running around in flak jackets and feeling terribly self-important, before rotating to Moscow, decided to stay in the States, having been posted here, then went to NPR, worked at NPR in DC for 10 years, ran shows, ran news podcasts, ran news casts and such like, all that good stuff. And then looked around for something exciting and lovely to do in the right part of the country where public media is alive and well, and found WAMC, and it's the best job I've ever had.
Yeah, we won the lottery. So when you tell people, Casey, you're a journalist, what's the response you tend to get? And what's the answer when they say, well, how is that as a gig?
It depends on where you are, of course. One time in the swamps of Florida, literally the day before Joe Biden was inaugurated, I encountered a guy who was taking a bike ride, and he was hunting boar. And he,
who do you vote
he was,
for?
He was just, yeah, I don't know. But and he was saying, hey, don't go down that road. They're hunting down there. And I was like, okay, thanks a lot. Where are you from? And I told him, Albany. What do you do? Oh, I'm a journalist. Are you a Republican journalist or a Democrat journalist? And I said, well, you know, there were not supposed to be anything party-wise. And he seemed dubious, but he said, do you think we'll ever have another Republican president in this country? And I thought about it for a while about what would be the right answer. And I said, you know, whatever anybody says about what's going to happen in this country, I don't believe it because nobody knows. And he was like, that's right, brother. And so that encounter ended on a happy note. Usually when I tell people I'm a journalist, people just look at me like I just told them I've got a skin condition or something like that. But at the same time, and seriously, and over the course of, you know, everything that has happened over the course of the last 5 years, and in that I include COVID, Andrew Cuomo, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Donald Trump again, I do get the feeling that there is a renewed sense that people understand the stakes of what is involved in journalism. And that is a good thing. So we are in a game of chicken between the good things about being a journalist and the things that perhaps might make certain sectors of the population see us as pariah.
Do you think that the awareness is there?
That they get why
what
we
you
need
do.
Journalism?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think some do and some don't. And when we talk about Republican and Democratic journalists or readers, there's some pressure, I think, always for us to have a point of view, and there's an expectation that we lean left. And one of the challenges, and I think great accomplishments that we've seen in at least hyper-local independent journalism, is the ability to really toe a middle path. And that's something that is so vital to the mission of the paper that I'm running. As soon as we start to go down the path of, well, we really are covering this neutrally, but we really think this is what should happen, I think we risk really alienating this vital core of readers that really lean on us. And I feel this tremendous sense of responsibility, Joe, in a way that I didn't when I was a reporter for Newsday many years ago, to think neutral on every single story. I know that's not exactly your question, but I think that's a really important point to make about the pride that I feel in being a journalist and the reason that I don't feel any guilt or awkwardness in saying that this is what I've chosen to do for my profession right now. Does that make sense?
When we were doing the introductions, you used the word hyperlocal. What does that mean to you in the terms of the journalism that you do?
It means that we are at every town board, every planning board, and every zoning board of appeals meeting. It means that when a local person is arrested for drunk driving, it is in our newspaper the next day. It means that when the Office of Cannabis Management yesterday shut down a smoke shop right across the street from our village hall and police department, we are there. We're listening to a police scanner, and we are over there. And I could give you countless other examples. It means that when our town board decides that they want to take a local boat club by eminent domain, in 8 months, we've written 42 stories about it.
Wow.
So that's what hyperlocal is. And it's very different from local. I was a reporter, as I mentioned, at Newsday, a really good local paper. I covered the New York City Board of Education, which at the time had 100,000 teachers, 1 million students, and 1,000 buildings, roughly. this job is more demanding than that job, right? My phone is literally in my hand. I sleep with this thing in my hand. And I, you know, even now I'm like a little anxious.
Yeah.
I want to
check. You don't know what you're missing.
I don't know what I'm missing. And it's a compulsion, hyperlocal.
What do you feel is the sort of the state of the journalism and how that environment is currently in what you're doing, given that the program covers such a wide array of topics?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think interview shows are complicated in that way. It's a very particular form of journalism. And, you know, in every story that is published in a newspaper, you are citing multiple sources and you're bringing competing points of view to bear in it. When you're doing a program that is basically an interview with one person, you are getting that person's perspective. And it is the host's job to challenge that perspective, to ask difficult questions, to follow up, and to do all of those things, but you're still getting one point of view. And so if you're discussing an issue that is contentious, we will certainly get mail from people who say, well, you didn't talk about this and this and this and these other 15 things. And we have to say, well, you know, that's all completely valid, but the show is only the 1 hour that it is, and we were only talking to one person. And in fact, although you can challenge things, you can't challenge every single statement that an interview guest makes because it just falls apart. And this is a conversation I have with producers even if we're working on a prep for an interview. Like, we're not trying to pick out and sort of, you know, nail every statement that this person has said in the last 5 years and challenge them on everything because it stops being a conversation and you're not hearing their point of view. You're trying to prosecute at that point. So the issue of balance is tricky, and it's also, I mean, to get to what Emily was talking about a little bit, this is a more partisan environment, obviously, than I think any of us have seen in our lifetimes. However we may think, at least in national news, however we may think that we are behaving neutrally, that we are reporting without bias, the perception in the world is otherwise. And I think that is just something that I think, you know, I try to be frank with. We try to work against it to the degree that we can. But there's less and less desire, you know, if you're in an environment that is perceived as being, let's say, liberal, there is much less desire for people who are, let's say, conservative to want to come on that program and be interviewed because there's a million media outlets. And those guests may feel that they get a fairer, easier interview on another outlet. And the same is true in reverse. You'll see that on Fox News as well. So
was it especially challenging this election season in covering the mayoral race?
Well, we didn't cover the mayoral too heavily. The focus of the program is pretty national.
Right.
We did an interview with...
by that whole New Yorker thing.
That's a confusing thing about the New Yorker, because, yeah. We did an interview with Zohran Mamdani, but, it, you know, sort of... as he was basically appeared to have already clinched
right. The
nomination. So, you know, and that was an interesting interview, and I think there was a good sense of challenge and investigation in it. But we were not, you know, also interviewing Eric Adams about, you know, Albania or anything else.
Sarah Gilbert, before you came to WAMC, there was a program director there who was one of the founding members of the radio station, a man by the name of David Gillette, who I believe was the first news director at WAMC. And he used to, as the network got larger and larger and larger, he used to refer to us as the United States of WAMC. And every time he said that, we usually rolled our eyes. But I think it's an interesting... especially from what we've heard across the panel, because the news that we're covering is we cover seven states. And so national is fair game, what's happening, and sometimes we get hyper-local too. So what is the challenge in sort of putting that out there and putting it into a ranking, if you will, of, okay, here is what we found today, here's what we're presenting to you of what is important that we feel you should know to be a member of this community?
I'll answer the question a slightly different way, which is coming at it from my background, which was mostly international and national news. having the opportunity to actually come to a community and find out what matters to the community and try to surface the conversations, whether they are about how a national issue is resonating locally or how things which are happening across a listening region, whether it's in upstate New York and also differently in, you know, Connecticut, joining the dots between those experiences and helping people to understand how lives connect across the region inside of an existing community is a real privilege and an honor. I mean, I think it's really the difference for me in seeing what I thought was important reporting and news at the BBC by going to far-flung places and trying to tell the stories of people there. It's actually much easier to have impact and see impact and create community and create a conversation about what's happening that in that community when you are part of it. And I think WAMC, if I may say so, and this has nothing to do with me because I only arrived yesterday, but the long-standing staff at WAMC are the people who created that sense of community because they have the ongoing conversations with people around the listening area every day about what's going on. And AMC is a little bit special because it's not just, you know, it doesn't just exist because it's the state public radio station. It actually genuinely is made up of people who stand with and for the values that the station espouses. And they want to be part of that conversation. It's not about where you live, it's also about standing with the values of the station. And I think that really makes it special. And you can see the impact there.
You certainly can. I'm interested, Casey, I asked you the question of when you say you're a journalist, but why do you think there is often a negative connotation to journalism and to journalists?
Well, I think kind of the political thing aside, which I think is, at least within conservative circles, the perception is that we're all raging liberals. That is, based on my experience, not the case. But I think there is the notion that journalists are only invested in pushing on pain points in a given community, that we are in the business of retailing division, scandal, crime. There is the notion that in covering certain communities, we are extractive in nature, meaning we bomb into perhaps an economically disadvantaged community. We report on scandalous or sensational tales of crime or suffering, and then we bug out. And the Times Union has worked very hard, you know, including over the course of my tenure there, coming up with sort of a point-by-point plan for how we can ameliorate that. And that's everything from de-indexing stories about past convictions. You mentioned DUI. We used to cover DUI all the time. We tend not to now. And if somebody calls up and said, I got a DUI 12 years ago, when people Google my name, it pops up. You know, we have certain guidelines for considering when we will de-index a story. When you de-index a story, it tends to be more invisible to a web search, that kind of thing. We are far less likely to use mugshots for a lot of crimes. There's that kind of thing. The only way, I think, to cure that concern that we are sort of a platoon of scandal mongers coming into your community is by being there to cover the good things that happened in your community, to celebrate the people, the institutions that bind any community together, whether it's on a kind of house by house basis or in terms of, you know, political leadership that is trying to improve things and make change. So you've got to, if you cover both sides of the community, people will be there and have faith in you when you're doing one or doing the other. In other words, they won't see you as the Chamber of Commerce when you're saying something positive, and they won't see you as the yellow journalists of yore when you're covering something negative.
Editor of the Times Union, Casey Seiler. We'll be back with more from our WAMC On the Road event from Gallery 40 in Poughkeepsie, New York, after this short break. Welcome back. We're airing a WAMC On the Road conversation centered on the state of journalism, democracy, and upholding our First Amendment rights. Panelists were WAMC CEO and President Sarah Gilbert, executive producer of the New Yorker Radio Hour, David Krasnow, founder of The Daily Catch, Emily Sacker, and editor of The Times Union, Casey Seiler. As we resume, I ask Casey how many full-time reporters work for The Times Union.
In our newsroom, we have almost 60 people, but that's editors, web team, photographers, and of course, reporters. We've got more reporters than we have anybody else. And as I noted, the Hudson Valley team, which is not in the newsroom because they're scattered around the region, is, I think, about 8 or 9 people strong now. You know, that's not a large contingent, but they are covering it in a very specific way, looking for the stories that matter. We do not attempt to go to every school board meeting or planning board meeting. We can't. But we try to cover it sort of a little bit like a U.S. Marshal would try to cover a region.
Right.
Where you are going after the stories that are the most impactful in that region.
And for those regions, it's important to cover those regions. So you, as you just indicated, for both positive and negative coverage, that those communities come to rely on the newspaper.
Especially these days when so many communities everywhere, but especially in more rural communities or deindustrialized communities, are becoming news deserts, when local journalism is fading away due to lack of resources or the business model is just not supporting it. That means that the necessity of covering those big stories becomes that much more important.
You mentioned 60. Roughly how many people when you started?
When I started at the Times Union, it was twice as many.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Without a doubt. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Every department was at least twice as big. Now, that sounds really bad, but compared to what a lot of other mainline legacy news gathering organizations have been through, I am lucky. I am either lucky or smart to stay where I am. My paper is owned by the Hearst Corporation, not to polish the apple, but if you look into the moves that the Hearst Corporation has made, the newspaper group in recent years just purchased the Austin newspaper from Gannett. And I don't need to tell people in this audience that Gannett has faced headwinds significantly. Yeah. Recently, it's great to have another paper in a state capital in the newspaper group. And only a couple of, I think it was about 6 weeks ago, Hearst purchased the Dallas Morning News, which had been stalked for purchase by Alden Global Capital, that if you know anything about it, rapacious website that has scooped up a lot of papers. The less said about what happens to many of those papers, the better. Alden offered more money to the shareholders in the Dallas Morning News, but primarily because the family that owned and controlled the Dallas Morning News for years and years, they decided to go with the Hearst Corporation, basically recognizing that the Hearst Corporation was far more likely to preserve the values and the robust journalism of the family.
So you come into the community, and you feel that there's really no paper there that's covering these issues that are
it's
so important.
It's not just what I feel, it's true.
So it's not there at all.
No.
And so you say, okay, I'm going to do it. Now, how many people are covering these stories?
We started with me 4.5 years ago as the only reporter.
Yep.
We added then a reporter to cover the town of Red Hook, which is the town I live in. More about that in a second. Then we added a reporter to cover Rhinebeck. Then this year we added a floater who covers the two towns' boards of education, farming, and the environment. So we added subject-oriented reporters, beats, right? We also have a social media editor. I have no idea how to do social media. She does. We have an events, obituaries, and comments editor because we get hundreds and hundreds of comments and we curate them and push them back out. And then we have a production editor and a managing editor. So I don't know what that adds up to. Some of them are part-time. I want to digress for a moment, if I may, to talk about what hyperlocal news means in the context of politics and the question you were answering. So I trained in 1980. My internship that summer after I graduated from college, I'm dating myself, was under Bob Woodward at the Washington Post. And Bob taught me something really important that summer, which was about access. He said, put aside having opinions. Your job this summer is to get 10 sources. Now, that probably doesn't surprise any of us who lived through the Watergate era, but it was a new way for me to think about it. I was 22 years old. And I've taken that lesson with me as I've built the newspaper I'm building today, because to your point a minute ago, I live in the communities that I cover. I don't live in both of them, but I live in one of them. And I run into the people we cover every day, every day. And many of them are accessible on my phone. So, for example, the chief of police, I needed to reach him last night at 11 o'clock at night. I know when he goes to bed. I know where his kids go to school. I had to think about whether that was a smart move, but I needed to know what was the role of the Red Hook Police Department in this Office of Cannabis Management sealing up of this facility, right? So I'm making those kinds of judgments, and I'm making sure that I respect this tremendous privilege of access that I've been granted by those 17,000 readers. And that's how I think of them. They are sitting on my shoulders. They are with me at every interview. I want to please them, but I also want them to trust that I'm doing my job in a caring and careful and apolitical way. Make sense?
Yes.
That wasn't a question you asked, but
no. So you cover the story on the cannabis facility. You're talking to the police chief at 11:30 last night. Where does that story then go? How do people find out about it?
We have a website, right? We don't do print.
All right.
So we have a website. And we put the story on the website, just like any newspaper, I imagine, does. And then we also push it out in a newsletter. Now, this story broke early enough that we were able to get it into our 7 p.m. newsletter with a tag at the top that said, this is a breaking story, check back, right?
We haven't woken up the police chief yet.
We haven't.
Stay tuned.
So then we updated it over the course of last night and into this morning, and each time we updated it, we put a little date stamp on the story. Did that answer your question?
It did. Now let me ask one more. You mentioned a story that you were working on that you've done 44 stories on.
The Boat Club. Have you guys heard about the Boat Club? Well, my colleague, very talented editor at the Times Union, and his counterpart that he's mentioning, Phil Pantuso, who runs the Hudson Valley local coverage, they've been covering it too. And it's picked up. It's been covered in the whole state. In fact, I think the New York Times is doing a story about the Boat Club, the Red Hook Boat Club eminent domain issue. You can't sort of live in these parts and not know about it.
So my question is, of those 44 stories, who are they all written by one person? Or
No. They've been written by several people. So they've been written by the Red Hook beat reporter, because this is an issue happening in the town of Red Hook. Actually, it's happening in the hamlet of Berrytown, which is part of the town of Red Hook. Do you want to talk about how the town and village government system is set up?
No.
This is the heart of local journalism right here.
It is definitely the heart of local journalism.
Okay. Coterminous municipality.
So here's a little secret. Here's a little dirty, dark secret. I thought I was done with journalism when New York Newsday folded in 1995. I was not. And so as the editor of a paper as a 67-year-old grandma, I get to decide what I want to cover. And sometimes I want to help out, and sometimes I want to do that fun feature on July 4th when everyone else is on vacation. So this summer, I went out on July 4th, and I did a story about what's it like to be at the Boat Club on Independence Day.
Roughly how many people work on your program?
We are a team of 6 people, and we have some help from fact checkers and art people and others who are on the staff of The New Yorker.
So there is a crossover between the people who work at the New Yorker and the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Is there a crossover? So I directly manage a small team of radio producers, yes, and a technical director. Yep. And then we have help in making the work from a few others on the New Yorker staff as well. Yeah.
And the show is weekly.
Yep.
What makes the cut for you? What goes into that decision of what is going to be covered in that hour?
I mean, a lot of the time when we're thinking about an interview with someone who is prominent, we know that that person has already given X number of interviews. Our listeners may have heard X number of interviews with some of our better known guests. I am really thinking about how to try to move that needle forward and how to try to push the conversation beyond what people may have heard before. We're very well aware there are a lot of interview programs on air, on podcast, on television. Sometimes in public radio, we talk about we got the first public radio interview with this person, and we give ourselves a big pat on the back. We worked so hard. And it's like, yeah, but hello, our listeners also watch television, and television got the first big interview with that guest. So, you know, it's an economy that we're sort of fighting for, and we are always thinking, what has this person said before, and how do we get them to try to get off their talking points? How do we try to get what they haven't said a million times before? And if we feel that somebody is repeating things that our listeners probably already know, then we try to move through that as quickly as possible. It's a very heavily edited show. And so we are trying to move through the sections that are boring and our listeners are not learning from.
So this allows me to bring up the thing that I wanted to ask you earlier, actually, which is, so we were talking about the art of interviewing a single person whilst recognizing that you're looking for some further insight into an issue, but you're only getting one perspective on it. And I was absolutely fascinated. And I'm still thinking about, especially today and yesterday, the interview with Michael Wolff that you guys did.
Ooh.
I know. Michael Wolff is a controversial journalist, I would say. He's been interviewed endlessly. He's one of those people who is constantly on MSNBC or CNN or whatever. He's always finding a new way to bring a book out or blah, blah, blah. And he's been a central voice on the man formerly known as Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein and all the rest of it. And that was a fascinating interview because there was every reason not to do it. And yet, because he has kind of become a character in a story that he thought he had control of, it was fascinating to listen to David walk around the issue with him and tackle a very awkward question about why he's been sitting on this material for so long. And that's the art of a great interview, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
New Yorker editor David Remnick. So what went into the discussion to have to do that?
One of the things about working on a weekly, and my colleagues here on dailies will be sympathetic, is I can barely recall something that happened three or four or 6 months ago. When was that interview? Did we do that? No. Oh. I remember doing it. And we had a sense that he was embroiled in this story in a different way than we thought. And since the release of, the email, we have all learned that he was closer in with that source than we expected at the time. Yeah, and an interview like that is not edited heavily because we're actually being very, very cautious around how much we are being extra sensitive about not wanting to compress too much, not wanting to package too much. So it was fairly tight to what was recorded in the room.
Give us an idea of the size of our staff and of the...
Total, I think that we are just shy of 50 full-time and just north of 50 with a couple of part-time staff, but the newsroom is small. I mean, it is a small but mighty newsroom, I would say. 15, maybe, including shows.
Which, small, but larger. I mean, obviously the largest of any radio station in the region.
We have a huge listening area.
Yes, absolutely.
And the way that we do it is we literally spend no money on carpet, no money on paint, no money on anything except the reporters in the bureaus out across the listening region and the staff that it's necessary to support that work. I think to me what was so absolutely enchanting about arriving at WAMC was I knew that it was a mighty small train, a little engine that really punched above its weight. Wow, yeah. Those are some metaphors that are mixed for you, but you know what I mean. The real joy of getting there is watching the next generation of reporters explore the craft learn the trade, work out how to tell a story well, sometimes make mistakes, learn never to do it again. But they are, like, this is the thing to be excited about. There is a generation of young journalists who can see how hard it is, who can see how sometimes little regard journalists are held in, but they can also see, especially in this moment, how important the work is, and they are excited to do it.
Can I jump in on something?
Of course.
Because Casey said, you mentioned the term news desert, and if you follow the media, which I think all of you do, you know, this is a huge and very, very important national story, and the decline of local news, you know, in so many places across the country has been huge and very detrimental, bad for democracy, et cetera. I have to say that living in the Hudson Valley, I've been kind of like shocked and surprised and delighted by a really thriving ecosystem of news organizations. I mean, AMC is, you know, paint or no paint, like a regional powerhouse. I've been really delighted to like see how, you know, the Times Union's coverage, like all the way down to Kingston and beyond. I live in Kingston. There is still the Daily Freeman still publishes regularly there. And obviously Emily's publishing across the river. Kingston also has a hyper-local news blog called Kingston Wire. Also a very small, but, you know, quite serious and devoted effort. For all of the bad news, and, you know, the panel called The State of Journalism is always like, oh, boy. But for all the bad news, like, there are some real bright spots here. And the Hudson Valley, it's been a pleasure sort of getting to know it and getting to know more of the media outlets here.
Do you think that is because the Hudson Valley is especially well-seated with folks, especially kind of post-COVID? There's been so much talk about the out-migration from the city. Those are people who, I would say, they have a constitutional expectation that living in a place, you are going to have access to news about that place.
I don't think I know the answer to that. I myself am part of that out-migration in transparency. And it's not just a COVID thing. I mean, it's, I think, for a decade or decades.
It's a digital thing, probably more than COVID. You know, the ability of people to work remote, I think, probably drove that a lot, too.
Yeah.
I want to jump in, too, if I may, and I agree with so much of what you said, but I also take issue with the idea that the Hudson Valley is set for news, if there's any implication that you're walking away with that. The Poughkeepsie area does not have a viable newspaper, okay? If I had the money and I was 20 years younger, I would be marching the Daily Catch slowly down Dutchess County to cover Poughkeepsie. And we get requests from the supervisors and the supervisors of the towns, the mayors of the villages, please, Daily Catch, will you come cover our town? So there's a lot of great stuff happening. The Poughkeepsie Journal, if I'm not mistaken, is owned by Gannett, which is in turn owned by private equity. The Kingston Freeman is owned by private equity. Private equity destroys newspapers.
Alden Global Capital.
I just want to make sure you don't get the impression that we think everything is good here, because it's a disaster, frankly. It's a disaster.
And not all small newspapers are good.
That's right. But we are, right?
Uh-oh. No. I'm not. No,
here we go.
The Daily Catch
is amazing.
May I tell a brief anecdote?
Please.
Okay. So Brendan Lyons, who's our Capitol Bureau Chief and our investigations editor, did just a scorchingly good story out of Sullivan County. A gun was errantly smuggled into the jail. In other words, car was stopped, three guys in it. They found one handgun there. They arrested the three guys. They went to jail. They went for their initial court appearance. There was an interrogation by a state police officer and one of the local cops. All the time, this one guy, it turned out, had a gun in his jacket that was loaded. That gun only was discovered when eventually he was finally processed into the jail for, you know, awaiting arraignment or, you know, a disposition of his charges. And he basically bragged to another inmate, man, they didn't even notice that I had a gun in my jacket. They went through his clothes. They found the gun. An incredible, perilous breach of security that happened back in August. And the sheriff and the district attorney, as far as we could tell, did nothing with this, informed nobody about this, including the state commission that is supposed to be apprised when something like this happens in a local jail. So Brendan did just a great story about it, a long investigation that we ran that was on the, you know, our Sunday front. And I kept waiting for other news outlets in Sullivan County to pick up that story, to pursue it, to look into it. There has been virtually nothing. And in the case of one local paper there that I will not name, the extent of their coverage was to just copy and paste into their site the denunciation of our coverage from the local district attorney without, as far as I could tell, you know, raising a finger to do any kind of, if you want to knock down our reporting, go ahead and do it. If you want to do your own investigation and look into it, go ahead and do that too. But anyway, in other words,
do you have a sense of why?
I don't know. I don't know if there was a sense that we were an interloper talking about sort of local officials and they felt the need to give those local officials a platform to defend themselves. I would imagine that this is an outlet that does not have a ton of resources, and maybe they just feel they can't penetrate that story in their community for whatever reason. But I would not want to romanticize the small town paper. There are very good ones, very, very good, robust, tough-minded papers. But there are others that are essentially just kind of copy-paste outlets all over the state, all over the country.
Do you think the readers, the audience can tell?
Yes, and with local outlets more so than at larger outlets, including the Times Union, because people know what is going on in their community. When they see all of the stores closing up on Main Street, they know that the mayor's tales that everything is sunshine and roses is BS. But I'll let you answer that question.
Well, I think also we haven't talked about the model for local news, the economic model for local news. And your model is very different from our model. We are asking our readers to fund our newsroom.
You're a nonprofit.
We're a nonprofit, right? And I think this is both a wonderful asset, but also a warning. Because would, for example, I think there are a lot of people from Poughkeepsie here, would the town of Poughkeepsie residents support a local newspaper? If I came knocking on your door and said, I need essentially an average of $50 from every resident per year, I don't know if we could raise it. We've been asked to go to Hyde Park. Hyde Park is just south of Rhinebeck. It's economically impossible. We've looked at the numbers. We've looked at the average income in the community. I know now what it takes to raise the money to run the kind of newsroom I want to run. To do that work, I need a good, reliable journalist there covering that town every day. That's $60,000 a year plus benefits. Can I get that? You know, I'm throwing that out to you guys, right?
I will say that I think, like many things in the world that we're living in at the moment, that a lot of us are realizing that we're really going to have to join forces in order to make sure that essential services like good journalism survive. A few of us have been talking about that. I think it's being talked about all over the country. I think that the best way that we can come up with to survive at the moment, and you will see different iterations of this around the country, I do think that in this particular location, there's a very good chance of doing it well. Standing shoulder to shoulder and actually sharing resources is the only way that we are going to get this done. It's not a dog-eat-dog world where journalists are concerned anymore. It's really a team sport.
Public radio did kind of pioneer the model of begging true. People for money to support coverage that they valued. I mean, this has been a tradition in that part of the industry for 50 years. Nonprofit newsrooms in print is a relatively more recent addition. But obviously one thing that we haven't mentioned here is the destruction of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which has been, you know, has been funding that ecosystem. So as much as, you know, you've heard fund drives and you're like, oh, great, it's all, you know, it's all of us just chipping in together. Stations were also really being, you know, supported by an endowment for that purpose from the federal government, more or less from the federal government. And the implications of that, I mean, this is a very new development. The implications of it are not known as of now. But I mean, to your point, I did not mean to put an overly rosy picture on the state of journalism. I was thinking myself, like, where are my notes of hope? But it is going to be devastating.
Sorry,
for the radio ecosystem, and particularly for smaller stations and stations in more rural areas, stations where, you know, the median income may be lower and people are not going to be, you know, they may contribute some, but they may not have the same amounts to contribute.
North Country Public Radio, in the Adirondacks, their budgetary drop as a result of the lack of federal funding was, I believe, about double what it was at AMC.
Percentage-wise of their budget?
Yes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Now, I will say, as I mentioned, we'll talk. Because we know how important it is that we'll survive. And actually, we did a friends raiser with North Country to make sure. And we did a live event up in Lake Placid as well.
Simulcast?
Yes, simulcast. I believe, and God knows, I am no Pollyanna. Anyone who knows me will tell you that. I'm a full-on catastrophizer of epic proportions. But I genuinely believe that people have woken up to how important it is. I think we're having a fine display from our elected officials at the moment in why journalism is important and why holding our elected officials to account is so important. And I think we will be okay. It's going to be tough, but I think we're going to be all right.
One thing, if I could just throw in, my program is produced by WNYC, and something I was immensely proud of was that the station developed a program. Instead of licensing our show to station, well, normally if a station produces a program such as the New Yorker Radio Hour, it is licensed to other stations who pay a fee back. WNYC developed a system where the program will be given without a fee to stations that are in real financial duress in order to keep it on the air.
You've just heard an excerpt from our WAMC On the Road event about the state of journalism, recorded in front of a live audience at Gallery 40 in Poughkeepsie, New York. Our guests were WAMC's CEO and President Sarah Gilbert, executive producer of the New Yorker Radio Hour, David Krasnow, founder of The Daily Catch, Emily Sacker, and editor of The Times Union, Casey Seiler. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.